open.
Right, welcome to the Oath Podcast, episode 2. I'm Tom Woodhead from Hippocratic Mastering, hippocraticmastering.com. And to my left, I've got Paul Marshall, Lone Wolf.
Hi.
And he is iamlonewolf.com. That's his web address.
Correct.
He loves it. We've got Lee Smith from Greenmount Studios.
Fresh.
That's greenmountstudios.com. We've got Whiskers. Hello. Whiskersproductions.tumblr.com. We've got Matt J.
Hi.
Hi, Matt J, suburbanhome.co.uk, and Dan Keener.
Emmy nominee
Dan Keener. It does actually say that on my...
I don't know, I'm reading, you forgot to read that out.
Emmy Award nominated Dan Keener.
Thanks.
And you can find him at magpiesandvagabonds.tumblr.com. Right, so, how is everyone? Everyone okay?
Not good. Bad.
Yes, yeah? Thank you.
Cozy, good. Warm.
Right. Toasty.
Well, let's get into it. I wanted to talk about, last week I got a phone call from Lee here, and he rang me up to say, we've got a bit of a problem here. You know this album that I was going to send you for mastering like a few months ago? I was like, yeah, I remember it, yeah. And he says, I've kind of got it for you now, but there's kind of a problem. Some of the tracks are sort of pseudo-mastered, and some of them are normal, and some of them are old mixes or whatever, and basically it turned out that your hard drive had got corrupted.
Yeah, we had a disaster. Basically, we had a hard drive that we were using to record on, and we were backing that up, and in the process of the backup, it died and took the other one with it. So basically, we lost everything. We lost probably like, I don't know, nearly a terabyte's worth of music, including about eight albums that we were in the process of mixing at the time.
Oh my god.
Some of which were finished but just hadn't, you know, had final mixes agreed, and that was one of those where we had actually had the final mixes agreed. It's just that we hadn't sent you the non-listenable copies, because we I don't know if you guys do this, but at our place we always limit versions for people to listen to so that they're as loud as, you know, other people's records. And yeah, that was just one of the tragic moments. one of many tragic moments I've been through in the past 2 weeks.
Oh, God.
It made me feel a bit better once I realised that was just one of many phone calls that day.
Did you say it was a backed up drive as well that went?
The drive was being backed up when it went. So basically when it died, it took everything off itself and the drive that it was backing up to.
That's just... Oh man, that's just shit.
I am so glad I'm not you.
There's no other word to describe it.
Well, I'll tell you what, it's never going to happen again.
No, well,
we just spent £1,500 on a new system, so it won't.
So yeah, I wanted to find out what everyone does for backups. Does everyone have a system, or does anyone just leave it to chance?
Time Machine.
I mean, I use Time Machine, but when I was talking to Lee about this, like Lee pointed out that it's not actually that good if you're... while you're working.
Yeah.
I can use it while I'm working because I'm just mastering, so it's, you know, I'm not taxing my hard drive that much. But if you're recording like full multi-track productions and stuff, you probably can't use Time Machine at the same time.
I've only got an old MacBook Pro and it's not got that much RAM in it. And yeah, if I'm doing Pro Tools stuff, I only do demos at home. If I'm doing that sort of stuff and then the Time Machine's like, right, it's time. That's it. It's game over for a good like 10 minutes.
You can obviously schedule it though, so that it doesn't get in the way of your work. But at the same time, you want to know that it's kind of backing up at the same time, don't you? So.
Yeah.
Just do it like midnight every night. So they leave the computers on all the time, and then it's just like overnight, they just leave it to like update. Yeah.
It must be so expensive though.
Yeah, and the problem with our place is at night, for to keep our insurance, if there's no one in the building, we have to turn all the power off. So I'd rather go to bed at night knowing that power's off than leave it running. And we also had the problem that when I don't know about you guys, but our place, the way we handle backing up until now, because we don't charge very much money for what we do, we figure it that we'll track to one drive. When we finish that session, we'll back it up at the end of every day, and we'll say to people, we'll keep that for 6 months. But we'll always offer the session to the bands at the end of their time. But I think from now on, we're going to back up in three different places, because the guy at the data recovery place just said, you don't care about it unless it's in three places. That's what he tells everyone. Anyway.
I don't know about that, but I think it's more like you care about it once it's gone.
Yeah, you don't care about it until you've lost it, and it's not.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah. We've gone the opposite way now. We've got this raid system. It backs up in like three places, and we've paid for an online storage, so it's always there somewhere, even if it's in invisible.
What's your online storage like?
It's just Dropbox.
Oh, okay, but how big of a box have you got?
there's a sneaky trick with Dropbox. If you pay the, I think it's £70, and you get this thing called PackRat, which is, it's like an extra £30 or something on top of the 100 gig a year, and so it's £70 in total. And with PackRat, it means that anything that you've deleted off your Dropbox, they keep. So even though you get 100 gig, actually, it's retraceable. So it just means that your folder that you can see will only ever have 100 gig in it. And if you need to backtrack because you lost everything, it will always be there on their system. Right. Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
Is that a one-off fee then? Or?
It's just yearly. So
right, okay, so £70.
It's about £70, yeah.
Is there implications now with Dropbox and sort of the T's and C's of them owning stuff that...
Oh, I don't know.
Copyright of stuff that's in...
Tell me this, I'll just pay for it.
There is, but there's a lot of stuff in this kind of storage backups places now where the T's and C's change, and there's some degree of, you know, once you put it up... I haven't stopped me doing it, you know, but like...
Yeah. No.
But if you're doing it on such a commercial sort of scale...
Yeah.
There are rumours, aren't there, about cloud backup services, kind of almost like that rumour that used to go around about Leeds College of Music, where if you recorded anything in the studio at Leeds College of Music, they own it.
Really?
That's true.
Was it true?
Yeah. Pretty much. Yeah. I'm sure if you wanted to pay for the recording time by hour, then it'd be all right.
Well, I mean, the studio wouldn't... I mean, if you do a recording in Matt's studio, it's like Matt doesn't own... the master.
I do until they paid for it.
Ford Russia had a whole... I was explaining this today. I was like, Ford Russia had exactly that problem where we went into a studio where no one kind of talked to us about how much he was going to be paid, and we were like, yeah, cool. And then at the end it was like, well, you could pay us £1,000 a day for the studio, or we could just own that record and put it and sign you to our label. And we were like, that sounds bad on every way.
Well, in that case, I consider the fact that I've paid for my education through Leeds College of Music for them to let me use whatever I get out of the recording studio. You know what I mean? It feels a little bit kind of weird to say, yeah, you can use it as much as you want, get as much practice as you like, but you never get those recordings.
It's not that though, is it?
No, well, of course not. Yeah. I don't think they even know.
Sorry, defending my hill over here.
That's Leeds Met you're talking about.
Oh, I'm sure it's relatively the same.
Well, when I worked there, there was a guy who left in his final year because he didn't want the university to have the intellectual rights to what he'd done.
Yeah.
And how can they have the intellectual rights to what
he'd done? It was part of the contract that he signed by being there.
That's foolish.
Yeah.
I think that's a kind of standardised thing that... Mm. Yeah. That's,
really?
Yeah.
Because he knew he had a good idea.
Well,
yeah, he knew he had a good idea, and it was because he's done well out of it now, but...
That just seems insane that an institution can say, we are inspiring you so much that it's our intellectual property.
It's ours!
Yeah. I wrote these lyrics, but I don't think I would quite...
I think the idea is they work with people, but there is it's as creatives, it is murky, and...
I don't think there's any need to worry about that kind of stuff. Well, yeah. Even if they do own it, it's like, they're never going to go, you know...
It'd be extremely bad publicity, wouldn't it?
That's the whole point. And I think it's not to stop people doing stuff. It's to try and guide people. But it's inflexible, you know, at the minute is the problem.
I'd imagine we're looking at doing.
But actually, do you know what? The way I've described this is in terms of the recording stuff, one simple fact is they're not commercial licenses for the software. If you record it on Pro Tools, then it's an educational license. Yeah. So technically, you wouldn't be allowed to, like, you know, monetize. Yeah, even on that level, there's an issue right there. So it's not as simple as a very grey area.
From
someone who's in the middle of trying to deal with it all.
So the word of advice to students out there, and even if you recorded it in your educational establishment, you didn't really.
I just feel like we're being savaging Whiskers for 10 minutes.
No, it's just I had a whole conversation about that today because we're trying to iron it out so we can get people in to commercially use the Leeds Met Studios, and actually that the software issue is a major. It's kind of the first one, you know, even without any implications of contracts and things like that. all the software is kind of educational.
I tried to come into your place to pay. I tried to pay someone to come and mix at your place, and you know, they wouldn't have it. And then luckily, pulled me a favour.
Yeah, you see,
thanks.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. You see, interlines of stuff that, like, not cool and not cool.
Yeah.
And
so, anyway. Thanks.
Did you find those distressors that were?
Yeah. We were talking about this before. Yeah.
It's nice.
Yeah, very nice. Best kick sound I've ever had by a country mile.
A country mile.
But, yeah.
Recording farmer.
Yeah. Yeah. It's all good now. Yeah, our main studio is looking really good. It's always good.
You've got this new backup system that you're using.
Yeah, well, it's only gone in today, so they're using it right now. They're in a session right now using it for the first time, and my phone hasn't rung yet.
Right.
So I think it's all right.
Fingers crossed.
Actually, now I've just said that.
So no, I know you guys record to tape as well before you go to Pro Tools. Do you reuse all the tape? Or
not always. It depends on if the band want to pay for the tape or not. Like most stuff we do, I'd say goes to tape and then into Pro Tools. Mm-hmm. And then probably like 20% doesn't even touch a computer until it's, you know, we put down a 2-track mix. And then the occasional thing doesn't even hit a computer at all. And we've got a multi-track machine and a 2-track machine, and we'll mix down to 1/4 inch, and you know, the odd band will take away a 1/4 inch reel with them.
Right.
But yeah, it doesn't really save space and you know, recording to tape, because you still need to back all the stems up anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't suggesting it would save space. I just wondered if you had any kind of like worries about losing the tape stuff as well as losing the computer stuff.
Well, we back up everything that we do to tape, even if people aren't paying to use, you know, both.
Right.
At the end of a session, we'll always leave time or work over to, you know, back up anything that's on the tapes
to the computer.
Yeah,
right.
We just stem absolutely everything. Mm-hmm. Even like rough mixes, we stem them just in case it ends up getting used or it sounds better than a mix that you've put a lot of time into.
Yeah,
which can happen.
I remember you telling me a story about someone who wanted to use a vocal that you'd done on a demo.
They paid us a lot of money to use it in the end. Yeah,
they were asking how you got that vocal sound and how you did it and stuff. Yeah. And in the end, they just paid you to use the actual vocal.
Well, like, that's intellectual rights, like what we were talking about. You know, that I just felt like it was really cheeky of them to try and, you know, get me to tell them how we made it sound like that.
Yeah,
and when it was a really big famous producer in a really huge studio, and I just thought that's not fair, you know.
Didn't that happen just before I came in?
It might have been, yeah. And so they ended up buying it off us, and everyone was happy.
Yeah.
Especially you.
Yeah.
I think that was a good way of going about it, though.
Yeah, definitely. But to be fair to the producer, he said I had to try, and he was like, if I was in your shoes, I'd have said the same thing. And then he was really helpful, and I've spoke to him lots of times since, and he's been like, you know, really helpful and advised us in lots of different ways. And you know, he was just trying his luck, I think. And he was kind of secretly quite happy, I think, that we'd asked him for some money, because it meant that he could then... It wasn't him that was paying for it. You know, he went to the label and they fucked out for it. So, yeah, it kind of worked out good in the end. Definitely.
How about you, Tom? What's your solution in the end? Is it just Dropbox?
I don't have an off-site backup. Which is bad.
Whoa!
I use Time Machine and backup to an external drive, but I don't have an off-site backup. So I'd probably be okay, but if my house burns down, which you know I could say about a lot of things.
I had that a couple of years ago because I was backing up 3 times, but then my studio flooded, my old studio, not this one. And that's when I realised they were in the same place, and it was totally pointless.
Yeah.
I never think about it that way either. Yeah. You just think as long as it's in 3 different places, even though they're all in the same room.
Yeah. One of them's under the desk. Yeah.
I just keep making thoroughly disposable music. You know, I think that's the easiest solution.
Yeah, possibly. I remember I did lose... I used to make electronic music occasionally, and it was very time-consuming to do it well. not that I did it particularly well, but like it was very, very time consuming a lot of the time. But this is when I was like 18 or 19, and I spent literally about 5 or 6 hours doing about 50 seconds of music. And I was really, really happy with it. And I thought, oh, you know, I just need to finish this track, and you know, it's gonna be great. And then that file corrupted, and I didn't have any backups of it. And then I sort of lost the flame.
Yeah,
that was it. Just one faulty backup, and that's
yeah. I was sort of like, you know what? I just spent ages doing that, and none of my other files are corrupted. It was just that one. So,
computers have a tendency. I swear they have a tendency to only fuck up when they're doing something that's good. Like we have problems with that in the studio. They crash. You know, when you're doing something that's really, you're like, yeah, this is sound. Oh, doof, there it goes. You know,
that's why all my albums have made it to the bloody mastering point. Then I suppose. No one says anything.
You're still feeling bad about that review, aren't you? Yeah. Oh, let it go.
No, let's not talk about it.
What were you saying about the Kleiner Spinal?
Like, we walked in to start the Kleiner Spinal album, like, no type, like, you know, five days, 10 tracks, which for me is like, I don't let bands normally do it, stuff that quickly. And
I don't like bands.
I don't like bands anyway, you know, especially with Neil in them. And, and like, we literally walked in, did like, got set up, great, one track, great, started the second track, and the hard drive just completely died on the computer. And it was a Sunday, and it was one of those weird things where we were just like, I just don't understand, like, what's wrong. Because it was just slowing the computer. It hadn't just conked out, just everything slowed down to a complete kill. So it's like, but it could be this and it could be this, and then the next, but you're panicking so much that you don't quite know what's wrong.
I imagine the Kleiner Spinal boys, you know, were very in depth with the technical knowledge.
Yeah. Like, you know, press control alt command shift this while drinking loads of beer, you know. And
have you turned it off and turned it on again, mate?
No, they were that. Well, no, it was just that stressful thing of like, oh, we'll just let the computer cool down for an hour, you know, and things like that.
God. It's got to be the temperature.
No, but I was in that. Well, because it's in, you know, it's in MOOC as well. So like, I opened the back, and like half a like vacuum of dust fell out of it, and things like that. Yeah. But then it's like the next morning, I was like thinking clearly. We just took it straight to Clockwork, and they were like, "Yeah, your drive's pretty fucked." You know, the whole hard drive.
Could they recover anything?
I didn't really, because, you know, actually, I mean, going back to backups, because I do backup, I've got a kind of portable hard drive, and then I've got a kind of a backup time machine at home. I didn't really lose anything. Then the only problem was, is I'd only just moved house, so trying to find all my install discs they basically gave me a fresh drive. Yeah. So, and I couldn't find, like, the new Logic, so I had to use the old Logic. And then, which is all fine, you know, whatever, except I went in to record this weekend, like, booted it up, and then realised that I had no plugins, nothing, and the old version of Logic, and it were like, oh, God. And trying to boot up files off new versions of Logic. So
it's the weirdest thing. My friend, I've got a friend in Canada who does, like, composing for film and TV and video games and stuff, and it seems to be a spate of, like, people's hard drives just dying at the moment. Maybe it's like at the end of summer, they're just like, fuck it, let's just everyone just Mayan 2012 and shit. And then he's one of those guys who's obsessive about backing up, so he's got RAID systems, so he's got two drives like in the computer, and then about two or three more external hard drives he's constantly backing up. And he has, because he's got quite a lot of plugins, he has like a USB hub with God knows how many little iLock things plugged in. And one day he was like, I just watched his Facebook feed just change like every like 10 minutes. It was amazing. It was like, oh, holy shit, this is my main backdrop, you know, my main backup disc's gone down. I've lost all of this series and all of this whatever. Then like 10 minutes later, I was like, the other one's gone down as well. And then more, it's like, how do five drives go down at one time?
It's like watching an episode of Star Trek on
Facebook. It was so good. And then he worked out what it was. It's like one of the iLocks was faulty, and it took down everything on this USB hub. And so like all of his hard drives died at once. Not, you know, couldn't get any stuff repaired. So, but he did.
That included his main drive as well as his backup drive.
Yeah, I can't remember how many. He had to get like a bunch more drives. But the cool thing was, like, going back to the whole backing up and then taking the drive somewhere else. Like every 3 to 6 months, he has another drive that he leaves at his parents' house. So he gets, like, goes around to his parents, takes it. And I feel like, you know, it's one of those things where you like pull up a floorboard and bury it and then put the carpet back over. He does that like every like
there's loads
half
of different
year.
Foreign currency down there.
Yeah, exactly. Just one unused revolver. Just
I do actually, shot. I know somebody who does do that. Who actually does have a whole setup going on underneath the floorboards. I'm serious.
Foreign currencies.
Well, it's like there's like a CCTV drive underneath there. There's all kinds of shit going on under this dude's floorboards.
It's not Lee Scratch Perry, is it?
No, sadly
Prince.
Not. Yeah. But no, he actually had his entire floorboards replaced with like this kind of MDF, like thick stuff. So that you could actually easily take like an angle grinder kind of thing and make different trap doors in it, so it's like a gold mine under his floor.
It would be quite a good recording studio if he's, you know, he's got thick floors and yeah. stuff.
It's not even a recording studio; it's just his house.
Oh, no. Just a guy. Yeah.
I got the joke. I got the attempted joke. It's all right. Pithy comment then.
It was hilarious. Thank you.
Has he got padded walls as well? He's got padded walls.
Well, I bloody hope so. He needs them, to be fair.
I can definitely relate to, like, you know, going absolutely overboard on the backups after my experience.
Well,
over
that's
the past
it,
few
yeah.
weeks. Yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Just because, like, you know, it seems bad at first, and then like after making 10 calls and breaking 10 different bands' hearts, and then you get like messages off, you know, different members of the band, you know.
I've heard a rumour that you lost my record.
Next thing you know, there's like 30, 40 people, you know, all contacting you, you know, asking you about this stuff, and you're repeating the same stuff, and all you can do is
how did you
constantly
compensate
say
them?
Sorry. Well, we're just doing everything for free and giving, just starting again, basically.
That's got me a nightmare, though. Jesus. You're taking like a month out to just...
2 months.
Fucking 2 months of working for nothing.
A lot of work, yeah. Oh, but geez. Like me and Jamie have been working...
But you had 2 months free. So it's kind of you backed up the 2 months.
What we've tried to...
Yeah, you wouldn't have been doing anything. Like.
We've tried to move... We've had to be really careful because, like, I think if we were just like, let's try and tackle it all straight head on, I don't think we'd be able to afford to keep running a studio. So we kind of have spaced it out over the next few months, and lots of bands have been really nice to us and moved their session like a month back and stuff, and it's been the only thing that, because we've had to plan it so that we had enough stuff arranged so that we knew we were going to hit the bills every month, and we've kind of structured it around that.
Though, as a band, you've got to be kind of understanding in that situation, really, haven't you?
Yeah,
I mean,
totally.
It's not like
I find that's a band's best quality.
Well, I mean,
especially towards the sound engineer.
Most bands should be able to relate to just completely fucking something up.
Exactly, precisely.
I did hear about Mike Skinner, the Streets guy. Like, his second album apparently was a result of him completely losing an album, like, that was on his laptop. Like, I can't remember. I probably read an interview with him like a long time ago, and yeah, he completely lost his second album, and apparently it was a lot more intricate and like and stuff. And then he made a really simple second album and sold a crap load of records.
Yeah,
so, you know, maybe some of the artists could have this kind of experience.
Well, we've been experiencing that once we're re-recording these bands' records, they're way better the second time round.
It's almost like you've
there's
done
not been a single
demos.
Record that's not sounded better for it. Yeah, and there's a girl who's in there today, and she was just like constantly saying how grateful she was, you know, that she's had a second chance.
I'm really grateful that you fucked up.
But it's
thank
meant,
you
it's
so much for losing my album.
The first time round, it was a bit of a panic, and you know, they've ended up with a much better record because everyone knew what they played.
Yeah.
All that stuff had been figured out, and you know, it definitely.
Well, you're also going to approach it. You're going to approach it a second time round with a like. I mean, I suppose. If they had any kind of feeling that what they'd already done was really great, then they've got to try and do it really
definitely.
Great again, haven't they? So
there's got to be that confidence where it's like, well, we know that we can nail this.
Yeah.
So you probably just it takes the edge off a little bit.
And also it gives you a chance to improve. So the bits that are great, you know, we keep them, and the bits that, you know, we thought we could have made a bit better, you can attack those now.
Are there any of the sessions that you're doing again where it is kind of like that, where you still have the basics and you just have to redo bits and pieces, or is it all kind of from scratch?
One of the best stories that we've had come out of it is a certain artist's record that basically we were so scared about the way this person would react, because they were kind of fragile anyway, that we remade her whole record from scratch. You know, by phoning around all of the musicians in her band and going, look, you know, this is a good idea. So let's not tell her, you know, just come in, we'll just redo it. And they, you know, they were all really nice and That's they gave amazing. Up their time. So we remade this whole record from scratch. And I phoned her up a couple of days ago and just said, hi, it's me. I've got good news and bad news. What do you want first? And she was like, oh, bad news. And I was kind of like, we've lost your record. And I was laughing, you know. I'd made this phone call so many times by this point, and that day I'd made several of them as well. And I was kind of like, oh, God, I don't know what's real anymore. And I kind of like, you know, we've lost your record. It's terrible. You know that hard drive that went down? Yeah, your stuff was on that, you know. It's like, it's really bad, hey? And she'd be freaking out. And she was just going, oh, my God, you're kidding me. What are we going to do? I was so happy with it. You know, it's the best thing I've ever done. I've never, you know, she gave me the, like, I've never been happy with anything. Now finally it's arrived. And I was like, do you want the good news? And she was like, go on. And I was like, we've remade your record.
And, so yeah. She just had to come in and sing on it again.
That's basically. It. But her reaction was brilliant. She was like, oh, well, I wanted to redo my vocals anyway.
Yeah. You shouldn't have just said we lost all the vocal files.
Yeah. Oh, well.
Well, I think that's probably a good time to have a little break. And when we come back, we'll be talking about making films and doing sound for film and TV and stuff. So see you on the other side. People closer than brothers. Some bombs are thicker than brothers. We howled at the moon and got. Okay, and welcome back to the second part of The Oath. And we're going to talk about sound for film and TV. So we've got Dan Keener, Emmy-nominated Dan Keener.
I think he's
the only one here who's Emmy-nominated.
Probably. Probably the only one with an administration job that's Emmy-nominated.
Or anything nominated, to be honest.
Best admin.
So I'll explain how I came to know Dan a little bit. Dan used to do sound for Mine and Whiskers band, Forward Russia. Used to do live sound for us.
Used to do sound at my venue.
Used to do sound at Whiskers venue before that. And
it's where we spotted him.
Yeah, we put him from obscurity to a slightly higher level of obscurity.
When you put me on a gig where the band kicked the shit out of me, you owed me a favour.
Yeah. Was that you? I thought that was Gary Moore. I'm sure I heard.
No, it wasn't Gary Moore. It was definitely me. I was up against the wall, fucking hand around my throat.
Who did it?
Some band called the Maybes from Liverpool. Yeah.
What had you done wrong? Cunts. Not enough reverb.
No, they literally got chucked out on the rear in the vine. I wasn't there that night.
No, you weren't there. They turned up really, really late. They were all clearly like coked up or something. Like, oh God, I make it sound like such a fucking Tory.
No, but they were, it wasn't. Well,
these young lads in bands.
Yeah, most of the people who used to inhabit the vine probably couldn't be described as Tories.
Yeah,
and they got pretty pissed off with them.
Yeah, they turned up really late. And I was like, and it was because there was an 11 o'clock curfew down at the Vine of those days. And we had four bands every night.
Super strict deadline, I remember.
But most of the deadline was because Jamie had to get his train back to work.
And it was like, they weren't headlining. And they went on like 20 minutes late. And I was like, fuck, I was spending like 15 minutes like, guys, get the fuck on stage. You're eating into your time. And obviously it was a lot more gentle back then. So I was like, come. Would it be all right if you go on stage? Because you've just wasted 15 minutes of your set. And eventually they go on stage, and then I let them overrun a little bit, and then I went up on stage and I was like, look, you're already like 5-10 minutes over. Just play one more and then go. And then they did one more and then did another one. And I was like, fuck this. And I was like, look, you're done. And pulled the faders down. And they tried to play another one. They're like, oh! And I was like, and
was
I was sitting behind
well?
The
was there a lot of people there watching?
Yeah, quite a few people.
There was a, I don't know how I've got this memory, but there was a point in the bazaars, weren't they? So they were pretty big. I think they were pretty...
I can't remember. Oh, James Mabbutt was on the door.
Yeah, I wasn't there. I remember hearing about it. Like,
don't
it was probably one of those...
Yeah.
But didn't Sean...
Get out of here!
Yeah. That was... Yeah. Sean kicked the shit out of them.
But the Bazaars were like pretty big pulls at the time. Yeah. They were pretty big in Leeds. So I think it was full for them, which adds to the problem as well.
Yeah, it was weird. And then they did the whole kind of like trashing stuff on stage. So by the time that half of them were being kicked out and half of them cleaned up, I was up on stage and there's just like SM58s with like no grills left on them, like stands bent in half. It was just... And then I had another band to put on after them. It was just, and I was shaking because I'd just been beaten up. It was fucking nightmare.
So did they just come over to the sound desk? And
I think it was either the bass player or the guitarist like came off stage, like up to the sound desk and slammed me against the wall. I was like, put the fucking PA back on. In a really weird Scouse accent, not that accent.
Yeah.
I was just like, Scouse. I can't. You're over. It was horrible. And then, yeah, bouncers had to get involved. Napoleon III had to get involved. Yeah. But it got serious.
But there's a good tradition of on-stage soundman altercations. My favourite always being Jamie chucking Alex Turner off stage.
I don't know about that one.
About that.
No.
Arctic Monkeys first on. And
this is Jamie Lee's studio partner.
Yeah.
Like, have you not heard
my,
that?
My, Jamie.
You know, I've heard that one.
Yeah, it's just like walking on stage, like, you know, no one knew who they were at the... Well, you know, it was a pretty busy gig. And just like Jamie doing a Jamie, like being on stage going...
That's it! Pulling cables out. Yeah.
So anyway, that's how Tom met Dan. Anyway,
to cut a short story long.
After that horrific tale, Dan went on to do sound for us and then other bands like Gaslight Anthem and
a load of other bands you've never heard of. And that's pretty much it.
Phenomenal funk band or whatever.
Phenomenal funk all stars.
And then you moved to Canada and
That went well. Back in England now.
But while certain elements didn't go perfectly, in terms of career, it went relatively well.
Yeah, it was strange. I don't know, strange series of events. I went out there because I've been on the road for quite a while, and I was getting a bit sick of it. It was kind of getting to that weird turning point where... I was getting very aware of paying a lot of money to pay rent and paying rent for a house where you're never in. And the only way to make rent in a house is to never be there. And that kind of started grinding my gears a little bit. And so, and I also wanted to settle down a little bit more. So I decided I'd go back to university, get out to Canada, do some studying and hope to get into like film, TV and that sort of stuff. Something a bit more with a...
Did you already know that you wanted to get into film and TV before you went out?
To be honest, I think I went out there still wanting to be doing like music stuff in a studio. But I don't know if I was ever really cut out for that. I get very, I get bored of recording my own stuff. So I don't know if that's a good idea. I don't think that's a good incentive to start going recording other people's stuff.
Possibly not.
And you, if you do like film, TV stuff, you don't have to talk to anyone, so it's quite as a bonus, as far as I'm concerned. Less people is good. And I did like a year long study course, which was a bit of a general over everything course. And my ex housemate, lovely man, guy called Peter Chapman, he composes music, and he's actually just done some music for Sony's Little Big Planet karting game, which is just coming out. He's done bits of that, which was amazing. He's a good guy.
Paul's nodding knowingly. Paul's...
I know that game, but I know it well.
Resident video game enthusiast Paul.
The man
nodding
who's got
enthusiastic.
Black Ops 2 coming in the mail tomorrow morning.
sorry to hear about that, Paul.
It's
sounds terminal.
It's pretty bad.
I'm really sorry for you as well because you're flanked. And
no. Are you getting it as well?
That's a gaming term, by the way.
There's this thing that Linz always says that you can, you know, people in bands can't be into games, football. You can't be into games, football, or music. Or you can only be into those three. Yeah.
Yeah, that's why I'm kind of rubbish at all three, because I'm a little bit into all three. Yeah,
but Dave Trains is the one. Like, he's pretty heavily into all three, isn't he?
I'm not into football at all.
Yeah.
And I love gaming.
You kind of like...
Yeah, I do. Sorry.
Yeah. You and Dave, you're the... winners.
Winners. It's a very elite competition.
Anyhow, sorry, back to the music.
Sorry, back to me, guys.
Back to the music.
And then, what were we talking about? And I did this course and I ended up, so my housemate, after I finished the course and I had very little else to do and I couldn't officially work for money because I didn't have the right kind of visa, my friend made a phone call to a guy that he'd previously worked on a movie with and said, have you got room for an intern? And the guy called Tom Bajelic, who's a wonderful, wonderful man from Urban Post Production Studio in Toronto. He's worked on he's done a load of, he's like a head sound designer there. He's done loads of stuff. Like he did all the Saw films apart from the first one. So he did Saw 2 through 7. Which is great because his sound library is all flesh dripping, knife enters wound. Like you're just like, oh my God.
That wasn't the sound of a knife entering wound, by the way.
Knife enters ass.
he basically said come on in.
That was finished, Leo.
Sorry.
That's the end.
That was good.
Classic. Yeah. Classic toilet
because
humor.
Because that's the noise asses make when you enter
when knives enter them.
That sounds like the tagline to the movie. Because that's the sound that asses make when knives enter them.
That's it, it's over.
We got tears in the studio, ladies and gentlemen.
Anyway, so you got this internship.
Yeah, I feel like he gave it to me as a favour to my housemate, and it worked quite well, where he basically, I've been using Pro Tools for a few years, and he got me in. He was like, look, do you want to do some background sound effects? This thing that's come in, it was a thing called Hatfields and McCoys, which was a big deal in the States, kind of dramatisation of quite a famous American sort of folktale-y sort of thing, and it's starring Kevin Costner and Bill Paxton. And so it was quite a big high production value to get these kind of film stars in a TV show. And I was like, yeah, cool. And I went in and he was honest with me a little while later. And he basically said we thought, I was doing a favor. We didn't expect anything, but I messed around with Pro Tools a bit and asked him a handful of questions and started getting on with it. And he was like, cool, we can use you for this. It was amazing. Yeah, exactly. I couldn't ask for more.
Amazing,
as a first show.
And
as
at this point,
like,
you actually
crap.
Got taken on as a, you did it. You did get paid for it in the end.
In the end. They pulled some strings and I got paid once my permanent residence came through and I could legally get paid.
Right.
But up to that point, I was officially just there's a gesture happening.
So, how did you find the difference between what you've been doing previously in live sound and working on the sound effects for a TV program? I mean, obviously, it's a lot of the same basic concepts, but it's a completely different job, really, right?
Well, the thing, a lot of them. I mean, the main difference was with doing live sound, I was the mixer. I was the final.
Yeah,
the final step before people heard it. Whereas for this, I was the first step. I wasn't even the interesting parts. Just doing the backgrounds, I was putting the winds in the trees and the birds in the trees, birds in the wherever, bird
just
in the wind
with the trees, basically.
Yeah, a lot of trees happen. Surprising amount of birds as well. So basically, I was just putting the shit that you never hear underneath everything else.
The invisible art.
Yeah, exactly. And it's one of those ones where you don't notice it until it's not there.
Yeah.
Although now it gives you a lot of respect for when you hear it done very well.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of things where it's kind of ruined TV for me as well.
I see you on Twitter quite a lot sort of saying, oh, there's no reverb in this program.
Yeah, well, that's it. And the other thing is have you ever watched... I remember telling the guy that I was... the guy at Urban... that, British TV, the low-rung British TV, we actually do quite well. Stuff and I was saying, stuff we do all shit Cracker and Minder and, stuff like that. And you know, even stuff like EastEnders, I'm like, it's quite, for something that's churned out every day, it's quite high production value. And I went over to Canada and listened to that and came back recently and I was just like, oh fuck, I wish I'd never said that. It's appalling. Like, it sounds terrible. If you watch Casualty, it's just like, it really feels like they're doing it in a studio. There's no backgrounds, there's nothing interesting happening. It's like, how can you make a hospital sound boring? Like, people are dying left, right, and center. You got open heart surgery, and there's nothing happening. Like, for fuck's sake. The other thing is that you watch TV shows, and I can now recognize bird tracks, fox noises. And I didn't realize there's a lot of weird little in jokes where my boss Tom was doing all loads of specific sounds, and he was him and all his buddies who've been in the game for ages try and slip in the Wilhelm scream. Competitions between them to see if he can get it where they put it in. It's kind of sweet.
In completely irrelevant places, or
no, it has to be in a relevant place.
It's surprisingly used in so much stuff. I mean, buried beneath.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, there's so many war movies or whatever where you hear it. Like, but you have to hear it as, like, you separate the layers of the chaos, and it's just in
there. Yeah, and you're like, there it is. Yeah. There's this one. I don't know what it is, but I feel like in all of the sound libraries in all of the world, there's one metallic door open creak. And I hear it on every fucking program. And the worst thing is, you hear it on every program, but it's the same one every time someone opens a door. Like, I watched the whole of Lost, like, back to back at the start of this year. Every episode, like, five times, this one, and you're like, come on. Like,
how many metallic doors are there on a desert island?
You've never seen Lost. Hidden in various places.
Yeah, that's the point, right?
Yeah. But yeah, no, completely different to doing live sounds. But I took to it surprisingly well.
What's the process then when you're asked to do something? Do they say, here's a scene, do the background sounds? Or
yeah, pretty much. Like, for me, like, I feel like it's all about job designation. So you have... I don't know how well people know the way it's broken down, but with like the sound for a film, it's broken up into like music, and obviously there's composers who do all of that, or it's sourced, and then you have music supervisors who have to go through all the licensing process and blah blah blah. You have dialogue editors, dialogue recorders and dialogue editors who deal with all of the dialogue down to the stuff that's recorded on set. That's a different bunch of people, but there's like guys on set who are recording sound, then there's people who edit all of that, and then there's people who re-record stuff when, you know, ADR, which is, I think, automated dialogue recording, where basically you're just redoing the voice because the stuff you captured on set wasn't good enough. And you sync it up. And then
that's usually the bits where it's the back of someone's head in the air.
Yeah, stuff like, well, you can use alternate takes for that. You can, because you run the same scene so many different times, you can use alternative takes. Yeah. But if you haven't got anything good, you need to re-record it afterwards. Then you have Foley, which is usually one person and an engineer recording that, and those guys are amazing. Like, those people are just mind-blowing.
I'd love,
like,
to get involved in that stuff.
It is crazy. And the people you meet who do that are a little bit weird, but they're really amazing. So that's
so whenever I think about Foley, I'm always reminded, because there's always these things like you can record footsteps, but footsteps don't sound like footsteps on a TV. It's not that, but they say that about certain things, don't they? Like, certain things don't sound like what they actually sound like, so you need to do something else.
It
always
reminds
me of that Simpsons episode where there's a load of cows, like, a load of horses, and they're painting them up like cows, and they walk and they say, oh yeah, because they don't look like cows on TV. You've got to use horses.
Horses is a really weird one, because obviously, like, it sounds really, really corny, but a lot of the horse stuff, sometimes the Foley guy does it. Sometimes there's these specifics guys who do all the horse sounds. But you never get the sound of a horse on set, which is really weird. That kind of freaked me out a bit. So when you know it and you watch a horse on screen, footsteps never line up. But you never fucking notice as a viewer. You only know it once you've been told. So it kind of ruins stuff for you. But when the Foley people put horse footsteps in, it is literally coconut shells banging together. And it's a bit Monty Python. But I didn't realize that with, you know, people make phone calls to various weird kind of obscure butchers and get horse hooves like on sticks and like, just bash them on a bit of rock. It's really gross. But yeah, so that's Foley. Foley's pretty exciting. And then what we were doing was, what is called either sound design or sound editing. In my case, it was all sound editing. There's not really much design into it. Design is when you hear like, I mean, it's the really abstract stuff. So like if someone...
monsters screaming.
Yeah, basically, like like really kind of like magic spells, like stuff that has no noise and you have to make the noise. Sound editing is literally... okay, well, that's a dog. I've got to find a dog sound, like see a dog, hear a dog kind of stuff. But that was broken up for Hatfields and McCoys. It's broken up into many different disciplines because there's so much work involved. So we had, I did all the background stuff. So it's all wall to wall, scene to scene. And the way we did it is you get the episodes and then you have the time and you're like, okay, right, fill it, just fill it. Fill the episode. So with the background stuff, it's from the moment
you're almost not even thinking about what's happening in the scene. You're just thinking about what's happening in the background of the scene.
Yeah,
like you know what I'm saying. You're not. You don't really care what's happening in terms of the story.
No.
What's happening?
Well, that was the thing. Like it was really kind of the first time I watched it when we just got the first edits, and it's just sound that's recorded on set, so it's just dialogue and the video, and I'm watching the whole thing. Because when the sound department gets it, the video is pretty much, it's meant to be locked. It never is, but like it's meant to be pretty much a final edit. And you watch it once and you're like, okay, wait, well, it doesn't really sound like anything, but I can do something with this. But then for the rest of your process, you are listening to, you're watching a screen, you're watching the show with nothing happening. So you have to mute the dialogue and then you have to sit there and listen to the backgrounds. Like you have to listen to them, to nothing happening in like a wood cabin for this whole scene. Then nothing happening. And like it gets exciting when you do like town scenes, because then you're like, okay, cool, right? I can put some people in the background. Yeah. And there were some like logging scenes and there's guys like you put in like trees falling down and stuff like that. And that's kind of cool. Rivers I really like doing. It's quite nice.
You're a big Weezer fan.
Yeah, exactly. that was all good. But and then we had specific, and then so it's broken up into backgrounds and specifics. But there was so much happening in Hatfields, like because it's all Western stuff. We got a freelance guy in to do just the horses because there's so many horses and there's quite a lot of TV, like quite a long show, quite a lot of programming.
The horse engineer.
Yeah, basically. So it's one guy's job to do horses.
That's a job I could, you know...
get behind.
Yeah.
It's amazing. That guy nailed it. It's all these stuff like, you know, he gets like bridle moves and like horse snorts and stuff like that. It's
is he kind of a little bit of a horse whisperer as well? Is he really, you know, like, does he commune with the horses?
Come on, I need a better sniff. Sure, come on, sure, you can sniff better than that. Come on.
Yeah, I just like the idea of him psyching up the horse. Like, he must be bringing something pretty special to the plate if he's just the horse guy.
I think, well, yeah, he was a lovely
horses.
Man.
Does he provide his own horses?
Well, he provides his library of horses, and if he hasn't got the right horses, he has to go out and record some horses. A lot of just working with libraries,
right?
And stuff like that. Right. And then my boss Tom did a bunch of specifics, but he basically went because he's the head guy. He basically went, I'm doing all the guns. It was like, fuck you, I'm doing all the weapons. This is going to be awesome. We just went through the whole thing doing all like the old like Winchester rifles and shit like that. And he did it. Yeah, it was amazing. It's really amazing. But and then we had like someone doing specifics is kind of boring. So there's some of it where it's really dull where it's like it's the specifics guy who has to do all the doors opening and closing because the Foley guy doesn't do those because you never get the right weight on them.
Right.
Because the Foley doors are all for handles and nothing else. So someone has to go there and go, right.
Record the actual door, you mean? Or
just use a library one.
Right.
Okay. We did all, and it's all like chopping in stuff. Like, so you'd have like a door close and you'd be like, okay, well I can sift through your database of shit. And you have like, okay, it starts. This can be the opening sound. This can be the clunking lock sound. You'd layer up all your shit. So you'd have like five or six tracks for a door opening. Yeah.
And people complain about records being over-edited and produced.
It's another world.
You watch a film and it's like...
yeah.
I don't think you've got much choice when it comes to film, though. I mean,
the bar's already set.
It's like, not like you can go, oh, I love that film because it's so lo-fi. You know? Yeah. It's like, you know, like...
It's all done on tape.
I mean, obviously you can, but but it's that kind of thing where, I don't know, it's because the art of it is stuff that, like you've just been talking about, it's the stuff that you don't even take into consideration until it's not there.
Yeah.
So if you took a film, even something as low budget as something like Clerks, you know, and then you suddenly removed all of the background sound from that.
Yeah.
So it was just the dialogue. You'd soon notice a massive difference.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
It really destroys things like documentaries. And then nature documentaries is a big one, because you're like, you watch like all that amazing Blue Planet stuff, and then you realize it's like...
None of the sounds real.
None of those sounds are real.
No.
Nope.
Yeah.
None of it.
Well, especially because most of it's slowed down and...
Yeah, exactly.
Like, pitch shifted down and stuff.
It's really... Like, the what the sound guys do is amazing, but like, fuck yeah. Like, nothing on TV is actually what's
happening. I read an interview in the paper with some of the guys who were doing the sound for the Olympics when that was happening. And they were saying how they, you know, they're happy to... supplement, I think they termed it, like the actual sound or create something, you know, for the replays or for the for like the slow motion montages at the end or whatever.
That would be
like,
fun.
Yeah. Like, you know, just kind of like creating new swimming sounds and stuff like that.
Yeah, I think I read the same thing. When the divers go into the water and the camera goes underwater, then you get an underwater sound. It doesn't actually happen. Yeah. It's expectation.
Yeah. So like you're playing on what people expect to hear to a certain extent.
Absolutely. So when you've done all of your sounds, then does it go to one person that mixes the whole thing?
Yeah, well, there's a weird thing called, and not everyone does this, but there's a weird thing called the pre-mix, which is where... Because obviously it's spread out with so many different people. We're all working in Pro Tools. It's like it's unanimously Pro Tools. Everyone sends sessions rather than stemming it out and everything. Everyone just sends sessions and you import the sessions. So you have one like big master session and then the pre-mix. And it seems a little bit superfluous until you do a session where there isn't a pre-mix. But some guy basically sits there and... basically levels out everything, because maybe the guy's done the guns, has mixed it really hot, maybe I've mixed it really low, and he's just basically kind of like, make it a little bit more even, and then it goes off to the final mix where, you know, so the pre-mix will be done with like all the sounds, like all the effects and sounds and stuff, and then maybe when you get to the final mix, you're bringing in the music, you're bringing in the final dialogue, you're doing all your room treatment and stuff, which is fancy way of saying reverb. And stuff like that, and your final level.
A lot of the times on these big productions, you can have like more than one Pro Tool system running, can't you? Because you need so many tracks.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. I think what they did when we did it is they usually break it up into two. So we mixed at a place called Deluxe in Toronto, where the desk is a huge.
You were there for the mix.
I was there for some of the mix. I went to the playbacks, which is basically where final thing, and then maybe someone will do some tweaks. So I was there for a little bit of mixing, but not all of it. But then, yeah, you have this huge, huge console, like it's ridiculous, and then half of it will be like maybe the sound effects and Foley will be on one side, and there'll be one guy doing that, and there'll be another guy doing music and dialogue, mm-hmm. and it'll be two separate systems. And then, you know, like a MIDI, I mean, not a like a timecode machine syncing everything up. It is crazy, like...
Yeah, I mean, I've heard stories about people syncing like 5 or 6 Pro Tools rigs together and stuff like that for massive productions. It's crazy.
Yeah.
And that's really with a lot of stuff like as stems as well, isn't it? Like, if you really go deeper, then...
We maxed out the desk. We were bouncing stuff down. So like anything that was too many tracks, you bounce down, and which is obviously that's hundreds and hundreds of tracks of stuff.
So who makes those final kind of aesthetic decisions to the whole?
For TV, it tends to be the producer. For film, obviously it's the director. Yeah. But for TV, it's the producer, which I was surprised by. Mm. I thought it would be the director.
I guess it's because with TV shows, a lot of the time they have different directors for different episodes, and it might get a bit like weird if you had different...
Well, this one was... The Hatfield stuff was directed by... I mean, yeah, you're totally right for like series, but the Hatfield stuff was all directed by a guy called Kevin Reynolds, who did Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, Waterworld.
So he's the Kevin Costner.
The Kevin Costner.
Congratulations on that one.
Yeah. So and it was kind of, obviously he's not like, he's not a low rung. Like some of the guys, they get to direct TV shows or direct like two shows in there in a lifetime and then be fucking out on their ear or something. So he was obviously quite like a big deal, but they didn't get him in to do any of those aesthetic decisions. It was all down to the producer at that point.
It's kind of, not to come back to computer games, but I've been playing that game Assassin's Creed 3 this week. And before I even knew we were going to be talking about this, I was really frustrated because there were bits that I guess they wanted to have the dialogue really loud. I guess it's like pop records where everything's way louder than it should be with the vocal. But it was really frustrating me because he was talking to someone and that person sounded like they were right in their ear. You know, there was nothing, there was no ambience to it at all.
It's weird.
It's really strange that someone was... It really put me out. It takes you out of the experience.
I mean, I've never played it, but the game, like from the adverts, it seems to sort of pride itself on its sort of cinematic kind of...
Yeah, well,
I mean, you played Arkham City, didn't you?
Yeah.
And Arkham Asylum or whatever, and... Like the dialogue and the sounds in that were just magnificent.
The sound design on those games is amazing.
It's insane. But like,
I finished Assassin's Creed today, and I think the credits take about 15 minutes to roll, and you can't skip them. And I'm sorry, I know you want to have your credits.
I didn't get a screen credit for Hatfield. So I would have loved that.
But Jesus, I couldn't believe it. How close
I'm not part of the guild.
You're not part of.
You're not
the good
part
stuff.
Of the guild.
Yeah, the sound editor's guild. Like, seriously, you had to be part of the guild to be credited.
And it's actually called the guild.
Yeah, it's like sound editor's guild or something. I don't know if it's the same everywhere. That's what it's like in Canada and I guess the States.
See, it's odd.
It's the same as having a thingy card, isn't it? You know, actors.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, but I mean...
Union.
What's the union called? But it's
the actors' guild. It's screen actors' guild.
There's a special card, like...
Matalan.
NUS?
It's called a specific thing for actors in England.
But like to go off topic slightly, it's kind of like I've seen a lot online recently about credits on digital delivery of records.
Yeah.
And we were finalising with my band's album this week and I was really specific. I was like, can we have the credits? Not just for me, but for the master and engineer and for the artwork and everything. And Cargo, the distributors of that record, came back and said there wasn't space in the metadata to actually put it in. Yeah. It blew my mind. I was like, well, I've actually gone out of my way to try and put it in. And there's nowhere because they do everything just by rote. They've just got these spreadsheets. They fill them out and stick them on. And I threw a bit of a strop about it. But it's so strange. Like,
there is
so
space
strange.
In the metadata, and that's the problem. But the people aren't willing to... incorporate that into their workflow of how they, you know, how they put the records online.
Yeah. You should do it like a rap record where it's just written into the title of the
song. Or just in the middle of the song.
I was going to say that it's like, it's really strange because I always thought that, you know, when you see the credits of a movie and it says music by so-and-so.
Mm.
Now, because I'm doing a score at the moment for a film.
Oh, cool.
And, yeah, but this is the thing. I saw the credits the other day, and it says, you know, music by Paul Marshall. And I was like...
I didn't do that film.
Well, no, it was more like, what the hell? No, but I was more like, I assumed
Jurassic Park, that's not one of mine.
I thought it would be, you know, as far as I'm concerned, the only involvement I've had in the music of that film is writing the score to it. But there's loads of other music throughout the film, be it music that's on the radio, be it music that's playing at a party that, you know, something that I didn't write. And so I assumed that the person that got the music credit was the person who actually put all of that and sourced it all together.
Music supervisor.
Yeah, I thought it would be more of a supervisory role rather than it being like music by me.
I think it's taken as read that when you're credited as a music, it's the original score, like basically. Whereas anything that's because they have to license all those extra things, you tend to get it broken down at the end with all the kind of like written by, performed by, copyright bullshit. But like it's a music supervisor who has to get all of that. So it's probably a music supervisor credit. And that's his entire job to find those other things.
Yeah, there must be. I mean,
by the time I saw my name, I was furious.
In a Bond, it'll be like music by David Holmes, but he didn't write the song Skyfall.
No, of course.
You know, and things like that.
Yeah, I think that's kind of what I'm saying as well. I mean, and in this particular movie, I'm doing all the score music, and I have to write like the end theme as well with vocals and everything. So I actually have to write the song for the credits as well.
So you are Paul Epworth as well.
But well, but it's kind of weird because I don't know, like, but like I say, through, I just wasn't sure that wasn't the credit I was kind of expecting to see, because maybe I've just been for a long time been misunderstanding what that credit was for. Like, because I've often seen, you know, like, you know, if you watch like a John Carpenter movie or something, for example, it will always say original score by John Carpenter and Alan Howarth, and then there might be a separate music credit, you know,
for supervisory
role. You know, I think that's kind of what I was getting at. I was kind of, it kind of almost makes it sound like I've done everything musical in this film, when in fact I haven't. You know, I've done the majority of it.
It's strange, isn't it? Like, I guess, you know, like you see. Big show, like big. I'm trying to think of. I've really stumped myself by starting a conversation. I can't finish. But like, you see a big production where you say like John Williams is doing a ET or whatever, and there's like 1 minute where it plays like, I can't remember ET, but like maybe they're playing like Huey Lewis and the News on a radio. Yeah, but it'll still say like so. It'll still say like music by John Williams.
Yeah.
But I think it's probably there so you can carve yourself like a composer's kind of niche, like, you know, so you're there. I am the composer, in the midst of time.
Somewhere it was probably insisted on by some kind of union or section of people.
When we speak of that film,
we want this credit.
Speaking of that equity card.
Equity
card. Oh, there we go.
That's a matter of land.
Got there in the end.
Yeah. And Nectar. Sainsbury's.
But yeah, so, I mean, like, it was interesting what you were saying as well, though, because I don't get to see any of that. You know, all I get to see is, you know, is this okay? You know, this piece of music, they say yes or no, or, you know, and then they take it, and then it's just on the film. You know, I don't actually get...
Are you not going to have a part of recording it or anything?
I'm going to be recording it,
right?
But I'm not... I'm recording it, and the director's coming over whilst I record it, so he can kind of continue directing me as well, you know, because obviously there's a lot of things that have to be exactly precise to the scene, you know, and I mean there are some things that are essential with regards to how you play it, so therefore, I mean, because a lot of this score is piano based, but there's loads of stuff where it's like you can't make the viewer know that the scene is winding up even though the music has to wind up. Do you know what I mean? Like, you have to kind of do all these kind of strange things that you're not used to doing. Like, you know, how you have like an ebb and flow of a song or something. You have to kind of just know that you've just got to stop it, or if you didn't write it to stop there, then you have to go back and rewrite it so it stops there to get convey the same
emotion.
You're
not writing a piece of music, you're writing something to support what's already there.
Precisely. Yeah. I mean, the only place you can get away with that is the end, like I said, like the end credits.
When you do
that
full-on James Bond thing.
When I become Adele. But at the moment, it's mainly just... I mean, there's some pretty kind of weird stuff I've had to score. A rape scene being one of them.
Hot.
I mean,
really?
Oh, damn.
But so, you do realise that if you do cut out the word that he just said, everyone will just be laughing. So it'll be a rape scene. No! Oh, rape. Quality.
Why did you say that?
what did you do for that?
Well, weirdly, I had to... I had to basically... The director's got very strict kind of... terms about how the music is made with regards to
music in my head.
Oh God! Can I just stress at this point there is a considerable difference between pornography and rape? Okay, but what I was going to say was he's strict in the sense that he doesn't like you to write something that tells the person, the viewer, how they should be feeling at the time of watching a scene. So therefore, you can't write something that's
escalating and going up.
That gets really kind of, that's just as hideous as what you're looking at. It almost has to be confusing to the viewer in the sense you're like describing how the characters might be feeling at this moment, you know, and in this particular movie, it's a really strange kind of, it's not like the kind of gang guy waiting down an alleyway, grabbing a female or whatever. This is actually like a, you know, it's like an abuse of power kind of thing. So you've been with this guy as his powers escalated throughout the entire movie, and it's got to the point where it's becoming it's actually kind of killing him inside himself. So it's almost like it's actually like almost like a desperate situation rather than a kind of that, rather than an attack, if you know what I mean. So it's, you got to be, it's a really interesting thing to be working on. Like, and it's like something that, that I didn't ever expect to be doing. So it's pretty amazing.
What was your initial like approach then? Like what were you given to work on?
What, for that particular scene?
No. Well, I guess everything. I mean, were you given like scene lengths to like compose something for this length? No. And this is what it's going to happen in it? Or were you given rushes? Or
did you have picture lock before you got it? Did you have like a...
Basically, the way it actually happened was the guy got in touch with me via Twitter, of all places. and I thought he was taking the piss at first, but it turned out to be quite a famous dude, and I didn't know, you know. And he sent me, like, he put together a version, because it's a Tunisian film, so he put together, like, a trailer with English subtitles and stuff, so I could just kind of get my head around it. And then I went over there, they paid for me to go over there, and then we sat and watched, like, the current cut of the movie that was, like, I mean, it's, like, at the time it was, like over 3 hours long, and it had loads of stuff that was, like, multiple scenes just because they hadn't got up to that point in the editing yet and stuff. So, you know, you had to endure a lot of film. But it was enough to leave it with a really kind of solid idea of where I was going to go. And I knew that, like, it was, there was one track off my previous album that he'd already put to a couple of the scenes and said this had a mood. So I knew from that what he's kind of looking for. But it turns out the moment I started doing stuff for it, you know, my idea was not wrong, but it was kind of like we still had a lot of, you know, back and forthing to do, so to speak, before we could find where we're going in the right direction. And I've been working on it for about 2 months now, and it's like, I was just out there the other week, and I was sat at the piano, and we're going through certain scenes and going, right, okay, that fits there, that fits there, that fits there. We need something here that I haven't written yet, you know, and it's, yeah, so I mean, it's more like I got to see the film and then see it in its lesser, like shorter and shorter and shorter versions. And now it's kind of almost, it's only just been defined, so to speak, which scenes and how long for and all that kind of stuff. But I mean, he's pretty much given me free rein on most of it, but there are some things that he really wants to make sure he knows that this is going to be used. I mean, I'm going to be using some traditional kind of Arabic instruments and things like that, so I had to go and it was really fun. I had to go over and just meet up with all these ultra famous Tunisian musicians who like play all these really rare instruments, and I just had to kind of sit there for like 4 hours through the night watching each one demonstrate to me how it should be played, you know, which was really kind of cool because it's
are
like
you playing them then?
No.
Has it been recorded?
Sorry?
Has it been recorded? Are you going back over there with a score? Or
yeah, the score, well, we're going to start recording it. Probably it's either going to be in December or January. We're going to be actually recording my parts here, get that kind of mixed here as far as we can, then take everything over to Tunisia to do overdubs with those instruments, basically, because I want those specific musicians to play. I can't possibly even begin, you know. I mean,
how have you written for those guys then?
It's more like we recorded sessions with them, and I got them to play because they wanted me to try and make them play the instruments in more of a Western way. So therefore, like it was a case of you know, they'd sit down, they'd play something for me that was like a traditional piece of music, and then I'd try and imagine, you know, I'd try and imagine how I could incorporate that sound into what I'm writing now, and then I'd basically sit down and talk to them and try and get them to play it the way someone like I would, and then we ended up getting some really weird effects out of it, like some really weird sounds, because, I mean, for example, if you've got stuff like there's a particular instrument, and the name of it it's a really ridiculously long Arabic name that I can't remember, but it's kind of like a really big dulcimer, basically, but it's played in this really odd way where you either have kind of the white notes or the black notes on a piano kind of thing, but the way you determine the two is by flipping switches on either side whilst you're playing it. It's really
crazy.
So I just sat down once, like, well, the guy got up to go to the loo or something like that, and I just sat down at it and I just tried playing it the way that I would naturally just pick up an instrument and
smoke on the water.
Exactly. First thing I do, you know. And then I came up with an idea, and then he came back in, and I got him to start playing that whilst I played along with the piano, or made some kind of percussive sounds on another instrument or whatever. It was really like really fun and like something totally crazy. Like, I mean, it's the sort of thing that, like, you know, I suppose that's what someone like Damon Albarn's always trying to do, that yeah. kind of thing where you get together with a bunch of people and try and use instruments in a way that's kind of not really how they're supposed to be played. But then that's the whole philosophy of it all, isn't it? Because it's playing them differently makes them do different things. So yeah, it's exciting, put it that way.
Epic.
Well, sounds
like an epic project.
But the strange thing is the score itself is really minimal. It's yeah. literally like piano, cello, the odd bit of kind of synth in a kind of like Brian Eno kind of way, you know, where you just need something very, very, very wide and ambient kind yeah. of thing. And then these kind of Arabic instruments are more like just to add a slightly different flavor to something that might repeat itself in the soundtrack twice or, you know, but it's really, really fun. And like it's just the only really upsetting thing about it is I just, as soon as this film's over, I just want to start working on another one.
Yeah.
So I've just got to hope that I get more work out of it because yeah. I really, really want to do more film work. Like well, really do.
You know, once you've done one, it's probably difficult to do a soundtrack for the first film.
Yeah.
It's definitely more so than it would be to do a soundtrack for a second film, I imagine. At least, you know,
well,
you can say I've done a soundtrack for a film.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, and like I say, I mean, luckily this guy, his last movie, he won awards at like Cannes and got invited to Robert Redford's house and stuff, all this crazy stuff. So, I mean, I'm hoping, like he's hoping that this will be selected for Cannes and awesome. And stuff like that. So, I mean, I'm just hoping that look, now I have seen that it's music by Paul Marshall, you know, and if that does go to Cannes Film Festival and stuff like that, and it's there on the screen, I'm hoping that there might be somebody there again. Just takes a little note, you know, so let's hope so.
So Lee, getting around to you, you've just done some sound on a film as well, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It kind of turned out to be a bit more epic than I was expecting as well.
So what tell us the story behind that then.
I think some a friend of mine who makes shorts just put me forward for some work with a bunch of guys who were doing their very first feature film, and they sent us a kind of brief and asked us if I felt like I'd be good at it, and then I had to send them some examples, and I've done some work on shorts before, and just sent them some stuff that I'd written for and some Foley stuff and some sound design stuff and I got the job basically, and just spent the past 2 months like working like a crazy person and kind of going a bit insane doing Foley work like you were talking about before, stabbing melons at 4 o'clock in the morning and stuff like that. I had the time of my life doing that. But yeah, so I've just finished the feature and it had a premiere last week and it went pretty well.
It was quite quick then.
So fast, yeah. They got us in and basically said, we've got 2 months and before we want to premiere it. We don't have to, but that's what, you know, when they had a lot of people who were helping them fund what they were doing.
It's crazy, sort of, isn't it? Like, they'll be out there like filming stuff for a year, and then they'll spend the next 6 months doing the video edits, and then it's like, okay, right, all of you guys, you've got about 3 weeks.
Yeah,
go. Better sound yeah. fucking amazing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I definitely felt like I'd had it dumped on me, yeah, definitely.
Was that you? Was that
no,
real?
No, it's the chair, man.
Metal door.
Knife leaving asshole.
There you go.
There is no metal door too.
This is a sequel.
But yeah, it's taught me a lot. Like, I felt like, you know,
well, you were doing everything then, like all the jobs Dan was just describing, you did everything.
Kind of, yeah. There was another composer who'd worked on it, but a lot of his stuff.
Were you doing music as well?
Yeah. A lot of the composer stuff didn't quite fit, and a lot of my role was kind of quality control on a lot of the stuff as well, and I used some of his stuff for. some of his music for like certain parts, but it didn't all work. After you know, a lot of the film needed a hell of a lot of sound design for it to carry, because it was a horror film.
It's good fun.
Man, it was so much fun. Yeah, I went and found like a big giant sheet of scrap metal from scrapyard, and God, that thing just came. That was like, I use that for everything, basically. All the rumbles, and I got really into like, I don't know about you guys, I get really obsessive with this kind of stuff. The moment you get your head into something, I cannot stop thinking about it. And I was like, not sleeping because I was excited, you know? And just basically it swallowed me up for 2 months and had a wicked time. And
amazing.
Yeah, I definitely recommend it. I'm the same as you. I really want to do more.
The
thing I loved the most was the sound design. The thing I kind of really got into.
Stubbing melons.
What's that?
Stubbing melons.
Yeah, stabbing melons. And there was a
really
couple of
terrible pub band.
Nice. But yeah, I think
coming soon to the Primrose.
It definitely taught me that there's like this whole world to audio that I'd never had any idea about.
I saw a screenshot you posted on Facebook or something of your automation lane for, I don't know what it was.
Yeah,
something to
that was the dialogue. Yeah. Right, okay.
Oh, and you were mixing as well?
Yeah, everything.
What the fuck?
Absolutely everything. And the biggest problem that I had, that I was really lucky because I've got a friend who whose housemate does big Hollywood blockbusters, and he's a sound designer and a mixer. And he basically put me in touch with this guy, and he was like my guru through the whole thing. And, you know, it was so good having a guy on the other end who'd been in my shoes, you know, because he's only a couple of years older than me, and he's been in sort of the industry in London for a while, but you know, he knows what it was like to kind of be where I am and you're just completely stuck. So I'd send him an email with basically what didn't kind of really make sense to me, what I was asking him, and he'd kind of decipher it and help me and point me in the right direction.
Awesome.
But yeah, it was interesting because I kind of didn't realise how complicated this stuff. And like you're saying, it's really nice to hear you talk about it before, Dan, because you're talking about, I was thinking, yeah, I did that. Yeah. Oh yeah, I'm that other guy too. And yeah, I did that next layer too. And it really does feel like that when you're working on it. It is layers, you know. I did a lot of the Atmos stuff first. So lots of field recordings of, you know,
rooms. Did you go out and record a lot of stuff?
Yeah, like I looked at libraries and stuff, but I'm so obsessive with this kind of thing that I felt like it had to be mine.
Libraries are weird because, like, it was quite a shock for me that it was how much of the stuff you just source from a database. Yeah.
Presumably, it's time is the main.
Well, that's
reason.
It. Yeah, time definitely. And money, like.
You've got to wonder, I suppose, unless you're really going to go into how would that door sound when it opens?
Yeah, exactly.
I went into it like that. Yeah.
But the stuff I was doing was all kind of like, if you're doing 1800s sort of stuff.
Yeah.
How the fuck are you going to record that in Toronto? Like,
you got no idea.
There's air conditioning everywhere. Yeah. There's cars everywhere. It's like, I'm going to have to source everything.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
the worst
definitely.
Thing is just going through a database and be like, okay, awesome. This sounds great. Oh, it's a plane.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Things like that. Yeah.
How did you record that? The field? Sorry.
Is that a duck?
That's exactly what I was going to say. There's your duck sound.
How did you record the field recordings?
Just on
what
a laptop.
Did you use?
I've got like a little portable sound card, an RME sound card that's got a couple of preamps on it that I think that are good enough. And
it's just bus powered.
Like, yeah, and I just, yeah, exactly that. I just bus powered it, and I've got a couple of Rode NT1, you know, broadcast mics that are pretty cheap, but they sound really cool. And you know, I just the best time to record is at night. Even though in my head at the time I was thinking like it's going to sound like night, it really doesn't. You know, so like it didn't make sense until you hear it in the day. but yeah, so I kind of did a lot of that, and then I got really into sort of trying to design these room tone things, like you were talking about before with reverb. I'd do the same with outer verb. I'd sample a space, you know, and then you know, so it calculates the reflection of the room. Reverb. Yeah, and there was like a scene in a confession box, and I sampled a cupboard, you know, because I just needed something that was wooden, you know. And but then I'd sort of, the more I read about this stuff, like I bought loads of books. Immediately I got the job, I was like, quick, get on Amazon, you know, you gotta act like you know what you're doing. So you're gonna have to do a lot of reading. So I just read up on it, and then the more I read, I like this idea of like the David Lynch way, where he'd have room tone, he'd have actual sound that you would be so low in the mix you didn't know it was there. So I was kind of developed like certain frequencies with looped tone, basically, to try and make each room have a feel in some kind of way. And that got really, really obsessive.
Yeah.
You know?
When you say looped, certain frequencies looped.
So like, I don't know, like I'd find a tone that, like, if like for the booth thing, for the confession booth, for example, I'd find like I ended up using like a synth, like an analog synth that went through like a space echo. So it sounded really tapey and old and kind of warm. And then I'd shove that through this convolution reverb. So it sounded like it was in a wooden box. And then I'd loop up a kind of interesting part of it and then make it really, really quiet in the mix. Mm. So quiet that you didn't recognize it was there unless it stopped, you know.
And gave you the feeling that you were in the box.
Well, yeah, that was the idea, but it just helped make things tense.
Oh, yeah,
and it was interesting because I didn't bring the room tone out until there was like a killing scene, and then I'd really pull up the room tone loads and make it feel really intense by making this sound that's been there for like 15 minutes that you don't even know was there really start to come up front, and it definitely made it feel really sort of unnerving.
That's interesting. Never heard of that before.
But I just read about it. It wasn't my idea. You know.
Cool. Right. I think that's probably as good a time as any to have call it wee. Quits for the night. Have a wee.
Yeah.
Thanks for joining us. This has been The Oath. Have a good night. See ya. Bye.
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 Serious like that second half.
Yeah, it was, wasn't it?
And just, the first half was all poo poo and wee wee.